but what we wanted to do this morning was to talk about children and violence and war from a couple of different perspectives. The first half of the hour, we wanted to talk a little bit about some of the cultural messengers of violence for children, namely television and toys. And then shift to talking about war. Not really a shift, because it's pretty connected in children's lives. And kids' attitudes towards war, kids' feelings about war, what to do about their feelings about war, that kind of thing. And the way we wanted to do it was, I was going to start with talking a little bit about TV and then about toys, and give a few, give a little bit of input, just a couple of minutes of input, and then see what some of your questions were about, start with television. And then I thought maybe we could try as a group to generate some strategies, what to do about television and kids. And I'm assuming that in a group like this, you have lots of different ideas, ranging from not having TV at all to other ideas. So I thought we could learn from each other what we're doing there, and then shift to toys. And then are there other areas that you really had in your head when you came to this, thinking besides TV, toys, and the whole idea of war and kids' attitudes towards war?
I think the messages, at least in our family, that children get from other children who are much more involved with the media, for instance,
and
we really aren't sure what messages those are. And how
So that could be one of the points of discussion about, no matter what you do in your own home, what happens
to the kids. When you say TV, are you including movies?
Yes. But I'll focus primarily, at least initially, on television, but then we can broaden it to talk about movies. Okay, in terms of television, both television and toys, I think that the concern is that both of those have an impact on children in terms of how they see conflict should be resolved, interpersonal conflict, and then also how they see conflict is resolved in the community. And that has implications, I think, in terms of who they determine are the bad people and what happens to the bad people and how do the good people overcome the bad people. And then that turns into a real attitude about the enemy and who is the enemy and how do you decide what an enemy is. You know, all those kinds of things, unfortunately, I think, are unduly influenced by television and by toys. And then that has international implications too. That besides what do individuals do when they have a conflict, and what do you do when you have a bad person in the community, then also what happens internationally if there is somebody you disagree with or somebody you decided is a bad person, how do you deal with that person? In terms of television, and some of this I'm sure a lot of you already know, that just a couple little things in terms of input. The American Pediatric Association has said that next to parents, television is the most important element in child development in the United States. That's kind of scary, I think, given the fact, you know.
I guess in some cases
it's more important.
Yeah.
They're looking at the overall picture, but that has implications not just in our own family, but in terms of the kids our kids play with, and in terms of school, obviously, too. And one little piece of data that I found kind of alarming, from 82 to 87, so right in the middle of the 80s, taking that five-year block, there was a rise in violent programming for children. And this isn't talking about primetime evening shows, but the children's shows. In 82, there was an hour and a half of violence per week. And by 87, there was 43 hours of violence per week on children's programming.
Is that cartoons?
Yes, that's mostly cartoons. Mostly cartoons. And that is predominantly a function of the number of cartoons that came out linked to the sale of toys. and obviously has implications in terms of the deregulation, therefore, of children's programming. Given that reality, now since 87, there was starting to be a slight drop because of the amount of pressure that parents and PTAs and pediatricians and, you know, a lot of groups and the Action for Children's Television were mounting. And I don't know what's happening just in the last 6 months now. There's been some concern that since the war, there might be a rise again. And I don't know. I don't have the data yet to support that or to say yes or no to that. But the last, like from late 88 on, there was starting to be a little bit of a decline, especially in terms of toys, but also a little bit in terms of television. The concerns that people have, and I'm sure you have, is the sheer amount of violence, therefore, that children are exposed to. The fact that in many cases, it does seem to desensitize kids to the consequences of interpersonal violence and to the consequences of war. And I think the whole Persian Gulf experience in terms of what all of us saw on television and how sort of sanitized that was for us has a direct connection to what kids have seen in terms of their own programming and their toys. And there were people that were saying that adults were excited that their kids could explain to them all of these missiles and all that because they had played with similar missiles and they could explain how the targeting was going and what the smart missiles were and things like that. So it seems like there was kind of a direct connection between that. And of course, that was a television war. You know, we all saw so much of it. And then the other thing that I think is, the other two things that I think are a real concern in terms of television is the whole concept of enemy and what that means in terms of kids' relations with each other on the playground and then how they begin thinking about people in other parts of the world. And then part of that enemy thinking in terms of each other spills over, obviously, into their behavior. And a number of preschool teachers, particularly, have talked about their concern about a real increase in aggressive behavior in 3- and 4-year-olds that they've been seeing. And seeing kids kind of going at each other with jumping at each other and kind of putting their feet up in sort of a ninja style, because of the Ninja Turtles, and that being their sort of instinctive response to each other. Now that's preschoolers, who are probably more impacted certainly by some of these toys that we'll talk about in a minute, but also very impacted by television too. Do you have other concerns or questions about television first before we start talking about what we can do about it?
What does one say to a child that violence is bad and war is evil when first they see the wonders of U.S. technology, mm-hmm. and then they are still greeted with images of millions of flag-waving folks following tanks down the main street of every city in the country.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the challenges, particularly now, in terms of some kids say, you know, adults tell us that we shouldn't hit each other or attack each other when we're upset with each other. Well, why is it all right for countries to do that? And obviously there are differences. I'm certain to say there aren't any differences, but I think it's difficult with kids to deal with that. We'll talk a little bit about that towards the end of this morning when we deal more with the war issue and patriotism, because I think that gets into the whole issue of patriotism too. Can you hold that till we get there? Other specific questions about television?
Yesterday, your husband talked about how you can, you know, work, Gandhi or whatever, to do stuff with your hands and you learn it. A lot of times we feel that I feel that you set a kid in front of TV, you're robbing them of those experiences. Yeah, just to work it out. I mean, they observe it. They observe conflict being resolved in a half-hour show, but no way are they working through a realistic time.
So it can rob them of creativity in terms of conflict resolution and obviously less opportunity to do things, to be creative, to be artistic, to, you know, be active too. I mean, there's real connection between physical condition and the amount of television the kids watch too.
And to be verbal, to use your own language.
To use words, yeah. The movie and video aspect of it, I think, too, is particularly a concern for older kids. That there's been a lot of, there's a group called the National Coalition on TV Violence that operates out of Champaign, Urbana, Illinois. And they've been real concerned about the number of slasher films that like 12 and 13 year olds seem to really be into and what kind of thinking that promotes in kids. And then obviously the real, the feature films too that really promote violence. There's a movement now, and I'll take this for what it's worth, but there is a movement to get, to ask Bush to recall his appointment of Arnold Schwarzenegger as chair of his commission on fitness. He's, because of Arnold Schwarzenegger's movie record through all these last, the Terminator 1 and Terminator 2 and all the other different movies. And there are some groups that are trying to get, saying he's not a role model for kids. I don't know, you know, how to focus it on one person. I'm not sure how effective that is, but at least it does make people think about that a little bit and think about the movie.
There's another side to that one too, and that is that Arnold Schwarzenegger is a bodybuilder, but that isn't necessarily the definition of fitness. And there's the side issue that the real question of the story that appears in Arnold's past.
Yeah, so it's besides the...
My concern about the video movie situation is that not just the middle-aged children, but the very young children, because then those movies are in the home, they think they're seeing those movies. They're in kindergarten seeing movies that I wouldn't watch.
Yeah.
And it makes me sick to think that it's just so easy because you don't have to get a sitter and go out to watch this movie. You think your child's just going to sleep while you watch it, or, oh, it's okay, we're here with them, we'll explain it later or something. That's real scary to me.
Yeah.
Think of all the preschoolers watching movies that before they would have had access to.
Yeah. And beyond their ability emotionally to handle, too. Let's talk a little bit about strategies. I thought we could write some of them up on the board. What can you do about television?
Limit its use.
We worked on a system with our kids so that it wasn't a unilateral. This is building on what we did last night, because we feel like these things have to be joint decisions. And we settled for a number of years on 7 hours a week was the limit. And you had to be intentional that before you could turn the TV on Monday, you had to have your list of 7 hours picked out so that the kids would go through the TV guide on Sunday and pick out their 7 hours. So they became more intentional about their viewing.
And then did you review that list and okay it? Or
yeah, when they were
pretty
little,
much. I mean, pretty much
they couldn't watch.
Well, but pretty much, I mean, the more you enter in and say no, 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 then you've destroyed the whole process. So we would make lots of compromises, I think, just because they were cooperating with the... But. And again, it depends on what age.
Yeah. We get that with our children too, and 7 hours is not a lot, but you know what, they ended up not watching as much. Because it's like an addiction almost.
Yeah.
The more you watch, the more you want to watch. So when you do start limiting it, they start doing other things.
Yeah, and then they kind of forget that I was going to watch television. Yeah.
The key, I think, is that we limited it together rather than we limited it toward them.
Mm-hmm. What other strategies? Sure.
Some of you may be aware of an organization called Clear TV. Mm-hmm. And Clear TV evaluates television.
CLEAR?
Yes, and it's an acronym which I can't recall what it stands for. But but it, but in caps, I think it's spelled C-L-E-A-R. And they evaluated content of TV programming and identify the sponsors of those programs. And then they had a concerted effort through direct contact with the sponsors, letter writing to the sponsors, to encourage and actually request that the sponsors drop their sponsorship of things that have graphic sex, violence, and other negative attributes in the program. And they have had some success with sponsors who were flagrantly in error in throwing their advertising budget toward these programs. Where they don't get success, then they organize boycotts. And they had one last year against the Menon Company. And finally, Menon did agree, because there were enough people involved with that who agreed not to buy Menon products that it had an impact on the company. And Menon did agree to back off on their sponsorship. At first, Menon was saying, well, you know, we're just putting our advertisements in, and we don't have any control over the programming, that's up to the networks. And Clear TV's approach was, no, you buy the time, you have say in, as to what you want to put your name on.
So that whole area of advocacy, writing letters to sponsors or writing letters to stations, sometimes mm-hmm. that's effective too.
Yes.
There was a group that got Friday the 13th and Nightmare on Elm Street, those shows off of television mm-hmm. in a number of cities by writing to the station.
Sure.
So that's any of that. And it may mean boycotts to a product's sponsors or of the station saying we're not going to watch the station.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
James Dobson is really supportive of that, and you can get information through Focus on the Family. And the nice thing about it is there's a lot of people doing all the heavy duty work to evaluate all this stuff,
so you don't
which
have
one
to,
person
yeah.
really can't do.
Yeah.
And they've really checked it all out in terms of minutes and numbers of violations
per hour.
Yeah. So then as an individual, you can enter into it through some letter writing and participating in the boycotts.
What other strategies have people used? Let's get a couple more before we go to tours.
We haven't had a television since my daughter was about two, and that was an intentional choice on my part. And instead of television, I have committed my evenings until she's in bed to other things.
Okay.
With her, now that she's 11, she's getting a lot of peer pressure about that, and it's come up a number of times as an issue that we need to get television, that kind of thing. And I'm open to that, and as far as it being a choice for her to make, but she needs to identify what things it is that we do now that she'll give up.
Mm-hmm.
And every time it comes to that, she says, well, you know, I don't think I want to give up Monday nights at the library. I don't want to give up this and this. I just point out to her, we don't have enough time now to do what we want to do, so we have to cut out something.
Yeah.
We're going to get this. I'm not going to buy this TV and not use it. So she's always changing her mind.
Yeah. Okay. So, but you're really in dialogue about it.
Yeah. I've said that she's old enough now that we can get one. I think she's old enough to watch what TV is on. But I can buy it and I can use it, and so far we don't think we're going to.
Any other strategy?
Well, illumination is nice, and we keep ours in a closet. And there's something about about having that security that there's a TV there, that if you ever needed to have that out, you know, to go watch a movie or something.
That's how we started, too, with it in a closet.
But it is tough, because it comes out, and it may stay out for extended times, and we can see it getting out of hand. And
but even just by putting it out of easy access, what a number of families that have just felt that it was overwhelming their family said that by putting it in the closet, at least they eliminated people just walking in and turning it on just to turn it on and not and maybe walking back out again.
We don't even have a TV room for it, so if you want to watch TV, it's got to be on top of a dresser in our reading room. I mean, it's like we don't have a place for it.
Yeah.
Right?
So you haven't built your home around.
Right.
In a lot of small rooms, that's what happens. Yeah. People with small houses, they have this 24-inch TV or more, and it's there. It's like another, you might as well introduce it. This is my RCA.
I just want to mention one other strategy, and then we need to move to toys.
I think that talking about shows, if you're going to watch them, especially with children, is crucial. And if kids are going to watch a movie or a show, that we take the time to watch it with them and then talk to them about, particularly talk about our feelings. You know, oh, it really makes me sad when I see that, or I really get angry when I see people operating that way. So at least we can begin to build up some sort of critical viewing skills, you know, because they probably will watch television sometime or another at a friend's house or something else, and at least they've got that other possibility in their head that, oh, maybe I don't accept this just because it's on television, or maybe there would have been a different way for them to have solved it. They didn't have to shoot the guy, did they? That kind of thing.
I think interactive TV is coming, you know, where, yeah, there are decisions. You program the show the way you should have it go in and rerun it and do it a different way.
Yeah.
In a different light, our son, I think, has been the one that limited us in the TV. I mean, we could not compete with the TV. He'd walk over and turn it off. There's no way he'd let us watch.
Watch again.
You know,
because he wanted your attention.
Right.
A little bit on toys. Very connected now to television, much more so than before 1980. In that same 5 year, 82 to 87, the statistics, I've seen statistics ranging from a 300% to a 600% rise in the sale of war toys in those 5 years. So even if you take the lowest percentage, 300% rise is that's not a gradual rise, that's a giant rise. And Nintendo, which has been for the last several years the largest selling toy. The concern about Nintendo is that 70% of the cartridges are violent in their focus. I mean, that leaves 30% that are not. But that a lot of people that have Nintendo, obviously, therefore have the more violent cartridges. In the sale of war toys, there was a beginning of a drop, too, in the late 80s. And whether the war will mean a resurrection of that again, I don't really know. And there has been some success, particularly the whole Rambo line of toys was dropped because of consumer pressure, because of parent pressure and other advocacy groups saying, you know, we don't want this for kids. Now, of course, the Ninja Turtles are so popular, and that's one of the... A lot of people have some concerns about that. In terms of strategies, and the other thing, overall concern about toys, there's a book called Who's Calling the Shots that's come out in the last year and a half, I think, on toys. And the author's concern in that, which is a little bit different, is that because of the connection between the current kind of war toys that we have in television, we have a situation where kids are not calling the shots in their own play, but are rather trying to imitate what they've seen on television shows. And the author's concern about that is that it's very damaging to their sense of dramatic play and their imagination, as well as the violence. Now, there are some people who are really opposed to war toys who don't agree with these authors, because the authors are saying it used to be years ago, if you were playing knights and, you know, you'd kind of build your castle and make your little moat around the castle or something, and you'd have your, but you as the child would be directing the play and thinking up things for the knights to do, or thinking up things for the other people to be doing. Whereas now, they're seeing a lot of kids not thinking at all, just trying to remember what was the last thing they saw on television and making their toys imitate that. So that's a little bit different concern, too, about it. It's still the violence part of it, sure.
There's evidence that, especially in preschool children, that after they've watched a certain point of television or are used to a certain exposure to television daily or weekly, based on CAT scan evidence, that they actually have brain atrophy. I mean, and that, so that that portion of brain will never be available again.
That's true. The connection, all the research that's been done, the connection between television and negative impact on kids is much clearer than the connection between toys. And, I mean, they can document increases also in aggressive behavior after kids have watched X amount of TV. It's a little bit shakier with regard to toys, but a lot of parents and preschool teachers say, I don't need social scientists to tell me what, you know, I know what I see when I see kids playing the Switch. Strategies in terms of toys, what have you all found that works to counteract the overwhelming amount of toys of violence? Are concerns that you have in that thing?
Before you get into that, is there any genetic difference in male, female with regard to toys? I mean, even without a TV, our little boy will pick up anything and use it as a gun, and he doesn't see it. And he does, I don't know. And how young do they get it? Yeah. And little girls, give them the gun and they will want to take it. Now, that's generalizing, but I've seen it.
Yeah, I don't know. I've seen some articles about that, and I don't think they're absolutely clear because it's real difficult to separate genetic influences from conditioning because conditioning starts right away. And people say, yeah, but I never gave my little boy a toy gun. But still, he just... conditioning, I mean, the environment is much more than just what we give to our kids. The words we use when we talk to them, the words other people use when they describe little, you know, all those things apparently are part of the overall conditioning. So I think it's hard to say. I mean, people that, and all of us that have little boys and little girls, most people say, well, little boys seem to be more aggressive. They just seem to be. And seem to want to play more. You know, even when they play with cars, there's more movement and more loud noise. I don't know. I mean, I don't think anybody's really been able to determine positively whether that's, how much of that is genetic. Do other people have input on that?
I have three daughters and they're older now. So when they were younger, there was a real push on making sure that you didn't just push dolls in their faces and all that stuff. So I bought them Tonka trucks and stuff. They never touched them. Didn't have a desire to do that, anything with them. And then I have a son who's considerably younger than the girls, and I've noticed the same thing. Before they even see anything, they're zooming in there. I have to believe that there's differences.
I just think you can't have a true experiment with it, like you're saying, Samantha, because our son plays dolls a lot. Our one son loves cars, the youngest one. The older one plays dolls and guns and trucks and the whole gamut. But when we're with other people, you know, they'll push the car in instead of the doll or whatever. And you can't be in a vacuum. We try, but we fall short.
But I do know one that's pretty close to the vacuum. I babysat for a little boy who had been living with his parents. No other children. He was the oldest child, and they were not living with the television or with any other people. They were like in a Holden area. That's not where they were. They came to where I live, and I started babysitting for the little boy who was probably about 15 months old. I used the word bingo when you fall down. Oh, bingo! Instead of, oh, poor child, or something like that. Within the third day, the little boy was saying, bingo! 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 He'd never seen a gun, he'd never seen television, I don't think he'd ever seen a child his own age. And he was doing this.
So
I don't know what that means.
But it does make you think about it, yeah.
You wonder.
Yeah. What about some strategies?
Don't buy war toys ourselves, and we also let family members know that we don't want to have them give those.
Key.
Okay, so don't buy them yourself, mm-hmm. And let others know that too.
And that includes clothes too. Mm-hmm.
Clothes and lunch bags and boxes and
everything.
Sheets. Yeah, just. What else?
Your ward toy freeze zone, which I didn't get into.
Yes, some friends of ours, when their kids were little, used to have like a box in front of their door, and they would say to neighbors, this is a war, and they had a sign, this is a war toy free zone, this house. And you check your guns and that right here in this little box, and then when you leave, get it back, you know. But we have other things that we play with, which is in a kind of a clever way to do it.
Because you're up against the peers all the time.
Right.
Which means that you have to have equally exciting things in your house, though, because our kids have to be able to bring their peers over, and the peers kind of look forward to being at the house rather than feeling deprived in our houses.
Now, so did those people have their own kids could own those kind of toys but check them in the box?
I think their own kids didn't own them, okay. From what I remember from what they told us. The other, just a couple of, I think, creative alternatives to this, too. Mr. Rogers says that one of the reasons for a fascination with gun play for little children is that a young child sees that his or her power over their environment extends as far as their arm extends from their body. That's how far they feel like they have power over their environment. And if you put a gun in their hand, or a rifle or something, it extends even farther, not just because there's that thing sticking out from their hand, but the range that you can pretend that kind of goes makes sure. So he's saying that a big part of this, the developmental thing, is power over your environment that children are trying to get.
Not only range, but altitude.
Altitude, too, yeah. And that one suggestion he has for parents is that you make more use of flashlights for kids. And when I read that, it was after our kids were little, and I thought of all the times I'd say, oh, you can't put a flashlight in batteries, and we'll, you know, use up all the batteries. But that does key into that same developmental need, because in all little kids love batteries.
And the garden hose.
And the garden hose. In the hot weather, the hose, too.
With the gun.
It's the same kind of thing.
Hey, compromises sometimes. I mean, that's true.
The other thing that a preschool teacher told me, that she'd done a lot of work on this, and what she felt with her kids, besides power, the other needs that she saw as part of what kids wanted to play with war toys or action toys was strength. So she does all kinds of other things to try to really key into strength, from having kids move things around in the classroom to all other ways, both for boys and for girls, to key into how strong you are. Oh, I need you to do this. Can you move this for me? The other thing is fast motion. She's made a connection between that. So she does a lot of making tubes, these long tubes, and they run their cars down the tubes or tennis balls down the tubes, that kind of thing. A third thing that she did, which I thought was really creative, when the kids wanted to play police, and she had some concern about that, about what that meant in terms of, she said, okay, we will play police, but the way they did it, they got those big orange traffic cones and made like streets, and this is in a classroom, which it could be applicable to a home. And then the people that were the police had tablets, and they could write tickets for anybody that went outside of the roadway. And it was kind of that same thing of wanting to have power and control, but a way of helping the kids see that could be done without using violent methods to do it. And then the other thing is a kind of a need for excitement and dramatic play. And all the opportunities we can give kids to do dramatic play, I think, are really also an antidote to their need for this kind of an exciting play. She, this same teacher was telling me that her three-year-old grandson that she babysits for, she said he will not just sit and read a book or play quiet. He's just not that kind of a kid. And so she's had to do things. She said he's got some little plastic bears or something, and they did things like the bears have been trapped by a hunter. Now it's up to us to figure out a way to get him out of that trap. And she said he'll play for an hour working on these bears and figuring out ways to get them outside. That all takes a lot of imagination. But I think the key thing is to key into the same developmental needs that war toys and guns and all that seem to be meeting in children. Does that make some sense to you? But that's particularly true, obviously, with younger children. Sure.
I have a question for anybody. Is I haven't really dealt very much with guns yet with my three kids. They're little, and we're living here, so we don't have a lot of other children until recently to interact with mine. And none of these children brought guns, I assume. But some mother told me a long time ago that she didn't say no guns because she found that if you said no to something, absolutely no, then there's this terrific fascination with it, and the child just can't understand why you would say no. So, let's assume, you know, my middle child finds a gun on the way home when we live in the world someday and brings it home and is just playing with it. And, you know, we talk about how I feel about it, but what do people think about just, after talking about it, kind of letting it be one of the toys so that there's not this hard and fast rule?
We've gone through a real evolution on that. We compromised on a squirt gun when Tom was six because he was petrified because the kids in the neighborhood were terrorizing him with guns because they realized his fear and he had to have something to stand up to them with. And his compromise proposal was a squirt gun. And I thought for him to have figured that out, I was going to affirm it, even though, you know. David came home with a plastic gun that looked exactly like a Saturday Night Special when he was about 9 or 10 years old. And I was just really uncomfortable with looking at that thing. And I, you know, we explained to the kids why we're uncomfortable, and I just said, Dave, I'm not going to say you can't have it, but I don't want to see it. It scares me when I see it. It reminds me of what that thing can really do. So if you keep it in your drawer, that would be okay with me. BB gun. You can only use it in a safe place when Darren's father is supervising you guys. But we okayed the BB gun. So there's been lots of compromises that we've made, but they've been the part of, they've been the fruit of negotiation rather than a solution that I figured out at the time. And I just feel that that process is more important than the decision that you make. Because the child then doesn't feel like this is being forced on them and then he's going to sneak or she's going to sneak whenever she can.
Well, I really agree with you because I think that when the child feels powerless, that's when they need to have these power things. And most children feel powerless because most children don't have parents who want to give them any power. And I don't know who brought up the question of the problem of the other children. I think that that really is, you know, the influence of them. And living in a world where parenting is not looked upon as taking any time or anything anymore. I mean, it's, there are very few parents who will come and learn about it and work these things out. And I work with kids, high-risk kids, and these kids feel so powerless. That's their biggest problem. They feel so powerless. So if you I really believe that's true. If you are giving them some power and some, so they feel like they are important, then these things aren't going to carry the weight that they will with the other kids whose lives are totally run by fear and everything else that the parents use to. Mm-hmm.
Let me tell you about an experience with my son. I grew up in the Midwest hunting, and it was as much a social event as anything, hunting with my father and my brother. And for 2 or 3 years, I couldn't carry a loaded gun, but I had to carry an unloaded gun. And after we moved to Alaska, I stopped hunting and sold all my guns and didn't have any interest in killing anything anymore. But we've been exposed to bear a whole lot, and with young children. Ultimately, we've come around that I now own some guns again and occasionally carry them on a long trip back in the bushes. But as a result of that, my son's been exposed to real guns, and all our neighbors carry real guns and shoot little things, partly in self-defense, partly to push back the wilderness, which we have a problem with. But kind of as a result of that and dealing with it and explaining guns, what you do with guns, what their real purpose is, he really hasn't shown any inclination to play with guns, even toy guns, as weapons of violence or...
Because he knows what they're doing.
I think so.
A similar thing, I grew up in the Midwest and hunted a lot, and since we've had children, I tended to go more towards skeet shooting, and I wish you could hear it, but we went, and as Laura's idea, just to use targets. You know, guns are okay, it's a sport if you use them for targets, and you're not destroying anything, you know, play a pigeon or something like that. But that really has been a saving thing for us, because you can still have a gun and there's still a use for them, because I'm afraid they're around for a while. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
But a different sport uses for showing people.
Shift gears a little bit, if it's okay, to broaden this to the whole question of war. This particular issue of the newsletter, our Parenting for Peace and Justice newsletter, was done in the middle of the Gulf War. If you open to page 4, what Joanna Rogers Macy has done there, she has done a lot on working with people on their nuclear fears through the 80s, especially with young people. What she says here is applicable to children in any catastrophic situation, as they face, you know, the imminent possibility of ecological, you know, or a major earthquake or stuff like that. How do you help kids deal with catastrophic events? And this is especially true, like during the Gulf War, these things just were really important, but they're applicable beyond the Gulf War. But we've really got to get our kids talking. And our Kath, I mean, she's, I think this is a general principle no matter what age or what we're dealing with, if we can keep the lines of communication open with our kids and give them opportunities to share their feelings, it's just critical, because they got to get the stuff out. Sometimes encouraging children to draw their feelings. The children in these refugee camps in Honduras from El Salvador, the therapy for those kids was to get them to draw what happened to their family or their home. Because they have to get it out. You've got to get the feelings out. And drawing is a safe way and a creative way to get feelings out. But that's just absolutely critical, that we've got to give our kids time. The opening story in this newsletter, written by Anne-Marie Hansen, our coordinator in Pittsburgh, is a beautiful, beautiful story. You can read it on your own, of how she worked with her children during those first days, but the importance of those kids getting it out. And how she did it, which means we've got to provide those cuddly opportunities for young children where they, you know, may be willing to share their feelings, or that we sit with them, you know, as you were talking about, and so you just really have quality time with your kids, with your daughter, and then that's the opportunity for some of these things to come forward, rather than just saying, well, how do you feel about it? I've got 5 minutes and I chose the time, you know. But that's crucial. One of the next really important things in terms of dealing with any big issue like this is that kids have to see that something can be done. And there's two things on this. One, they have to see adult role models, a significant adult in their life doing something about a serious issue is a tremendous source of hope. There's a beautiful movie that many of you may have seen called Mother of the Year. It's the story of Ruth Youngdahl Nelson, a Lutheran incredible grandmother. It's here. If you haven't seen it, take an opportunity to see it. But she talks about, she's just at the end of her life, she's giving this speech in Minneapolis, and she's saying, a school teacher friend of mine asked your kids, fourth grade kids, how many of you kids think there's going to be a nuclear war someday? And every kid in that class raised their hand except for one. And the teacher turned to Linda, and she said, Linda, how come you don't think there's going to be a nuclear war? And you know what Linda's response was? Well, my mother and father are working for disarmament, and I think they're going to win. She was the only kid in the class that hoped, because her parents were resistant. And it doesn't even have to be the same issue. Kids just have to see a significant adult, could be a teacher, could be a grandmother, could be an uncle as well as a parent, but a significant adult in something themselves. And that's like number 12 for her. This is really, really important that children see that they can. If you make kids aware of a social problem, but don't help them see that they can do something about it, you heap more negativity on them that just paralyzes them. They've got to see that they can do something. But if they see they can do something, then it's appropriate to introduce. As long as it's not introduced so graphically that for some little kids it overwhelms their psyche, like some of the Hiroshima films, you know, can just really overwhelm you in terms of the burn victims. A 4, 5, 6-year-old probably shouldn't see that. But to be exposed to the realities of war, yes, if they see that there's something that they can do. Deep connection with the people of Nicaragua. And have felt the tremendous responsibility because of our government's contribution to that war for so long to help children especially see how they can respond to these victims of war. And Quest for Peace is one of the best groups that has been responding to the war victims in Nicaragua. And they collect children's supplies and send those down, as well as, you know, medicines and blankets and lightweight clothes and food and stuff like that. But they have a special project for children to respond to the children in Nicaragua. And they collect school supplies of all kinds, sports equipment, musical instruments, simple things. But kids just don't have that stuff down there. We took 14 duffel bags full last year and a half ago with our kids down. And you know, we just saw that these, and what was really special was like one family in our community wrapped 100 bags, 100 little boxes of 12 crayons. They just got a simple little box of crayons, but they wrapped each one individually in a Christmas wrap. And those were precious. Those were really, really precious, and we gave those out. But you know, it's a simple thing that children can do. Whether you're talking about your own kids or grandkids, or it's the Sunday school in your church, but it is a project to respond to the victims of war who happen to be children, your children's own age. So that's just one thing. I wanted to mention those of you who are still concerned about the Gulf War and healing the wounds of that. I wanted to suggest one project. You may have your own, but the Civilian Casualty Fund. And you can take one of these if you want. I have just a few of them up on the table. The Fellowship of Reconciliation is an international interreligious peace effort that began after World War I to work with the victims of war, but also to be a lobby against the outbreak of war. And during the Gulf War, they started what they called the Civilian Casualty Fund. And they've been raising money for medicines, as well as collecting medical supplies to send to Iraq, Kuwait, Jordan, and to some extent to Israel. Wherever there were victims of the war, they want to respond. And they're trying to be even-handed in the response and not just single out, say, you know, Kuwait or single out Iraq. But wherever there were victims, but the majority of their supplies and dollars are obviously going to Iraq, which is because of the preponderance of the casualties being there. But I just feel that in our euphoria, in some cases, or in our just good feeling that there were so few U.S. casualties. I mean, our brothers and sisters are all of God's people, and the Iraqi casualties should be as much brother and sister to us as the American casualties. And if we're going to gloat as a nation, then I feel as an individual that I've got to respond to those who are not being remembered, and the war goes on because the casualties mount because of the destruction of their water system, their sewer system, their utilities. So if you share that concern, I highly recommend the Civilian Casualty Fund. Here's the rationale on one side, and then the addresses and phone numbers and specific needs on the back side. I'm not saying that this is for children, but again, there are Iraqi children that are the victims. So maybe we can talk to our children about those children so that they don't feel helpless, overwhelmed by that.
Well, just to add one thing. I think this can be a way for kids to, part of my concern is that there were a number of children during the war who were really worried, scared, wondered what was going on, why. And then all of a sudden the war's over. And I don't think that those feelings for children just completely disappear. Now maybe they're not worried now about being attacked, and I think some kids were, about their own loved ones being killed. But I think that some of the questions remain, and sometimes they go down deeper into kids, and they don't, they're, and some kids may be worried about what about all those people that got killed when we bombed them, and what, you know, and so that something like this might be a way to, even to get them to talk about those feelings again, too, rather than just, well, that's over, and let it go.
Something we did with our kids, and I'm sure many of you have also done that, is, you know, adopting the child through World Vision or Compassion International, where they can then write to the children. And when my daughters became teenagers, they took it upon themselves to then adopt their own children. And they take the money. I mean, that's just kind of a part of life to them, I guess. And that's been a really, something, the kids really get a, you get a picture of the child, and you pray for the child, and you can write letters to them, and you really, and the children, Compassion International, particularly the children, respond back. And so it's a personal thing that you are helping this child.
Yeah, I think anything that we can do to build bridges internationally, especially with people of color, because I think, and this, I think that there is some degree of racism in our and European policy, where if it's directed at people of color, it's not quite as bad, and we're more likely to use weapons of destruction against people of color. And so then if we can build bridges with people of color in our own society as well, and then especially around the world, those kinds of international connections, pen pals, whatever it is, I think are really important for diffusing that sense of the enemy, and the enemy being people of color. So yeah, I just applaud that whole approach. It's really important.
You know, what kind of bothered me about the war issue is that the children were upset. I teach second graders. But it was over so easily.
It was too easy.
And I remember them coming to school saying, oh, we won the war.
Yeah.
And I remember my uncomfortable response to that. He said, well, some of the fighting is over, but, you know, just talking to them about, you know, the results of this,
yes,
of the children and the people who, you know, were what we would say the innocent people in that. And it was such an easy war for them. The initial trauma, you know, and we spent a lot of time, we're lucky because we had someone that we could write to immediately, and that helped. But when it was over, quote unquote, they're just like, oh, we won the war, and everybody was so happy, and I'm just feeling like, it's not over. It's the worst is
that the realities of. One of the reasons I like the story of Sadako and the Thousand Paper Cranes, and that book is in the bookstore, is that it helps children understand the consequences of war and that those consequences continue. Sadako's story is a very gentle story. Do you all know it?
Mm-hmm.
Of a girl who lived in Hiroshima. She wasn't killed on August 6, 45, but she developed leukemia from the radiation at age 11, and her story is a real dramatic, it's a real gripping story of her trying to make 1,000 paper cranes as this plea for life, and she doesn't finish making the cranes, but she ends up making the cranes really as a plea for peace. But you see this girl as the victim of war, and that war is, the consequences of war continue even after the war is over. And then the making of the paper crane is such a good activity. Those of you who are going to be around next week, we're going to teach folks how to do that who've never done it before. But it's a wonderful activity for children. Again, if the hands do it, the heart learns it. It's such a symbol of peace and peacemaking, and it was created by this victim of war. So her whole story is a real moving story. And the making of the cranes, I mean, I organized the making of cranes and many, many schools during the war, because I just felt that was a response that the kids could get into, that would engage their bodies as well as their spirits. So there's something to that story, I think, for helping deal with the issue that you raised with.
When the children I was working with, especially the fourth grade up, I was so appalled by the excitement.
Yes.
And the, you know, they would just thought it was great, and the, you know, they could just, they wish they were there. It was, I was really tormented by that. I almost didn't even have it.
Yeah, it's hard. It was so hard at that time.
And then start collecting the trading cards with all the...
Yeah.
They were excited. There was an excitement.
Turn to page six for a moment in here. I think one of the major strategies is providing counter images to this excitement image that war or violence sometimes can provide kids. We've got to come up with exciting counter images. And the kids, they don't need lectures, but they need images. And this is where videos and books can make a real difference. These are a list of just a few, on the left-hand column, a few of the books that I'd suggest. This story, Weasel, if you got, I'd say anywhere from 10 to 14, it's a wonderful story. We'll leave it out if you want to borrow it, if you got kids that age. But it's the story of an aggressor. It's a good Saddam Hussein almost parallel. A real unjust aggressor that this kid wants to retaliate against and get. And he's helped to see that there may be an alternative way to deal, but he's very reluctant to try the alternative way. It's not this nice Pollyannish happy ending, but it's a struggle to find that there may be alternative ways of dealing with unjust aggressors. But it's a good story for that. For kids a little bit younger, at the bottom of the page there, Dr. Seuss's Butter Battle Book goes up to the top of column two. World War I is something like the Butter Battle Book. It's how a group of animals show two kings the foolishness of their arms race. So it's animals teaching the humans, which I think we had a lot to learn from the animals. But it's a good playful story for seeing the foolishness, to see how violence escalates, and it provides a counter image. Videos like Karate Kid 2, and do I mention it there? Yeah, they're over on the right-hand side. That's one of the best video images of a non-violent way to overcome hostility. Have any of you seen Karate Kid 2? I am sold on that for kids. If you're looking for a bibliography of other books, this yellow one, you can take a copy of it. 8 pages worth. This is not just on conflict resolution and non-violent counter images. It's also on good multicultural books and good anti-sexist books for children ranging from K through high school. So it's a wide range. Kathy put a lot of work into putting this thing together. So there's some wonderful models of alternative ways to deal with conflict for readers of all ages that are recommended in here. So take one of those if you want. This is just a drop in the bucket. You know, I mean, this is a major, major theme. I wish we had more time to deal with it. But feel free to use the written materials. If you're interested in our Parenting for Peace and Justice newsletter on a regular basis, I brought cards along that you can take one and fill it out, and you can get the subscription for $7. Normally it's $15 a year. So if you want to use this, you can save yourself a little bit of money. But this comes out 6 times a year, and every issue is a topical issue. And the range is very wide. So that's available. If you want some stuff, again, on the FOR, Civilian Casualty Fund, there's a sheet of that there. Our Friday session is going to focus on dealing with racism and how to multiculturalize our family life. And so this bibliography will be real helpful in that session as well. As I mentioned last night, if you take a couple of these things, they cost us money to print, so if you can afford to give us $1 to cover some of the cost, that would be wonderful. If you can't, take it anyway. We'd rather have them used than not be used. Okay?
And pets.